Hey everybody, and welcome to Better at Beach. My name is Mark Burrick, and we have a special episode for you today. We're going to talk a lot about training beach volleyball athletes, specifically talking to a trainer, Nathan Michaels, who has put about a third of his training business into volleyball athletes specifically. So he's going to know a ton, and he's getting to work with the highest level of volleyball athletes, which we're really excited to get into. Before we go into that conversation, I just want to talk about a few of our upcoming events. So if you are in Asheville, North Carolina, or anywhere near there, April 19th to 21st, we have a 3-day 21 and over camp. It's at a brewery, which is pretty cool. And we've got three courts. So it's going to be a 21 and over camp in Asheville, North Carolina. That is April 19th through 21st. On May 31st to June 2nd. Again, we've been saying it for weeks, but this is going to be our largest camp ever in Long Beach, New York, in Long Island, New York. We have a 3-day camp. So if you want to come out to New York, the beach where I learned to play beach volleyball and kind of cut my teeth, we're going to be there. So I get a nice little homecoming with all my friends and family. On June 2nd, if you're going to be in Hermosa, we have a beach volleyball fundamentals. So that's good for beginners, it's good for intermediate players, and it's good for advanced players who are looking to brush up on their skills. And we have two events on the same weekend, Virginia Beach and San Diego, June 14th to 16th. Virginia Beach and San Diego. And it isn't released yet, so don't look on the website. But within the next few days, we will have an event, a 5-court event for all levels, all ages in Bend, Oregon in the middle of July preceding the Seaside Tournament. So if you want to prep for that Seaside Tournament and you're in the Pacific Northwest, we are coming your way. Look forward to having you there. Last but not least, our Complete Coach Academy is up and running and our mastermind meetings start tomorrow, which is Tuesday, April 9th. We are opening this up to coaches. We're going to train coaches and club directors to teach you, A, how to operate your business, operate your team, design better practices, and how to manage players that are spanning all levels on the same court and still get them the reps that they need to get. So if you are a coach or a club director, I want you to check out betteratbeach.com/coach to check that out. And we are about to fill up one of our 5 spots this summer for a 3-day club consultation and training camp where me and Brandon will come to your club, your team, your school, and run a 3-day camp for your coaches and players and walk you through the season meeting by meeting, month by month. And hopefully we can teach you the Better at Beach way. All right, that's all for the announcements. We're going to get into fitness talk. We're going to get into training. We're going to get into all of the questions that you guys send me over Instagram and on our Facebook page. And luckily, we've got a specialist with us from Devour Fitness, Nathan Michaels. Hey, Nathan.
Hey, what's going on, Mark?
Thanks for your patience.
Of course.
Our announcements. We got a lot of events coming.
No, it's exciting, man. I am stoked to hear just volleyball is expanding everywhere. So this is amazing.
It is. You know, we're growing. I think as in terms of the groundswell, like athletes, juniors, clubs, schools, it's pretty crazy to see the old guard not only getting replaced, but getting trounced. I was just talking to my wife today and it's like the difference between a AA adult and a 15-year-old junior girl who has been now training for 3 or 4 years, they're not even on the same playing field. Like these juniors are coming for everyone and they're dangerous and they're good and they take risks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, no, exactly right. Even when I come from a smaller school in Texas, little Division I, 2A, Stephen F. Austin State University. And when they got their first beach program, that was kind of the turning point for me when I was like, wow, this sport really is growing if it's at my school. It was crazy. And I'm excited for it. They've been around for 3 or 4 years now. And yeah, it's fun to watch.
Now, you're a player yourself. Are you playing?
Yes. On a good day, I am roughly South Carolina or South California A rated, I would say. Because I know the ratings change from different parts of the country.
And we were talking off camera. You're a multi-sport athlete. So you came from set of background. Volleyball wasn't your first sport, right?
No, it was not. It was just something that we played occasionally in high school at the one court in town that was at the pool. Because back, you know, public school or public pools was a thing. And then I played, you know, for fun in same thing in college. We had some nice lighted courts that would, the lights would be on till midnight. And we'd go out there and play all the way till then. Probably two or three nights a week.
Nice. And you played tennis. So you played tennis in high school.
Tennis was in high school. Thought about trying in college. Didn't go so well. But yeah, played tennis in high school and then varsity basketball till I was a junior. And then I left the sport. But I tried hooping as long as a 5'9" kid could.
And as long as the ankles and knees and hips and low back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, all right. So I'm 38. I'm going on 39. Mm-hmm. And I will say that it gets more abusive. Indoor was the first thing to go for me. For indoor volleyball, I had had enough cortisone shots in my shoulder. I was trying to throw my entire body at the ball just to generate some form of power.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kept seeing piece by piece worse injuries happen, or me having to work around injuries so much. And so then I ended up switching to beach, where I thought, okay, you know what? Maybe this will be nicer on my body.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the people who are listening to us are around 25 to 45.
Okay.
And they're probably trying to stave off all of the typical injuries.
Mm-hmm.
The knees, the hips, the low back is what we see a lot of. And some sore shoulders.
Sure. But
to me, a sore shoulder is relatively easy to take care of if you just follow a shoulder routine and you're not trying to hammer balls that are completely out of your hitting window.
Like yeah.
If you just learn to shoot, you'll be healthier. And if you just actually carried a band with you and in your bag at all times, I think the majority of your problems will be solved.
Mm-hmm.
But how do we help people with their knees, hips, low back, those types of sorenesses that are starting to plague everybody once you hit like 31, 32, 33, depending on how much you take care of your body?
Yeah, I mean, it's the famous coach's answer. It depends, because everybody comes from a different background, a different approach. Have they been physically active their entire life? Do they have jumping in their history? If you've never jumped and you started late in life, that can set you back a while, even though there will be some what we call newbie gains to be had for that population. But yeah, if you strength train, obviously resiliency is always going to be much higher. So it always depends, but you can't go wrong with strong. So if you can just get your body strong in all the basic ways, typically you're going to have less tweaks and ouches and all that fun stuff. But it just depends. I mean, if you're somebody that plays a lot also, even though the sand is nicer to knees and the patellar tendon, we do jump a lot in this sport. I mean, even if you can only jump 2 inches off the ground, you're still jumping that 2 inches every other play, multiple times in a play. So the repetition starts becoming an issue there. So as far as my experiences with just general folks on the sand, not many strength train. And then a lot of them got obsessed with the knees over toe guy back during the pandemic, 2020. Most people took that a little bit too far. It helped other people, but I was all for it because it just helped some people that have never done anything try to actually, oh, maybe I should do something preventative to try to make my body feel a little bit nicer so I can continue to play, hopefully pain-free. And then that's another big stigma for me, is that I don't like believing that people have to be in some sort of level of pain to live life, and in this case, play volleyball. So if anybody has anything small that's not a joint or mechanical issue, I'm like, okay, let's see what we can do, because I hate when people live and play in pain. So yeah, it's a big answer. It depends.
Pain is crippling in not only physically, but emotionally too. You start losing all of your confidence because you feel like you're limited. And even, you know, socially or in relationships, if you feel like somebody's always putting a limit on you, your confidence goes down. You get a little bit angrier, a little bit shorter earlier. Now, when you're working with your pro athletes, do you think that they get angrier or they're affected by tweaks more than general population? Or is it kind of the same from person to person?
I would say, honestly, the professionals, it tends to be a little bit more on the fear side. because they're afraid of it getting bad enough to where they can't perform and maybe not even play at all. So people that have come back from knee things, shoulder things, hip things, if they were decently major, they're worried about that. Even if it feels great, even if their year is removed from the injury itself or surgery, whatever it may be, that constant fear is always there from what I'm finding. So it's, I dealt with in Texas more lower level high school, junior high athletes, strength and conditioning when I was there. But it's interesting dealing with an adult psyche as I'm diving back into high level adult sports. So, yeah.
What is, you know, I guess if you're adolescent or if you're like early teen, you feel invincible, right? You haven't had any injuries.
Yeah. And even if you do, you bounce back so fast. Oh, broken leg. Fine. 6 months. We'll be back. No problem.
But is there a right recovery time? Do you think that professionals are paying too much attention to tweaks? I mean, I was a guy that I figured out a way to work around every injury, and you could say that that was good. You could say that that was bad because for one, you know, you started developing new pathways of overriding, and then Your body kind of got used to an altered pathway. And then that in itself became inefficient or led to something else down the road.
Exactly.
However, you take 6 or 8 weeks off doing absolutely nothing, and that's not the answer, because
no,
you can't improve. Your body doesn't improve. Your psyche doesn't improve. So what should people be doing when they get the tweaks? Like, what's the first feeling, or what's the threshold? And then where do they go first? This might be more of a physical therapy question, but as a fitness professional, you're handling it.
Yeah. So my background was, I have a little bit in that boat just because I, once I got out of the music business, which is a whole other story, I went back to school for physical therapy, did all the stuff to get accepted, and then just kind of realized not for me. Clinical life is not that much fun in regards to what I would have had access to. So I don't ever claim to be a PT, but I have an idea of kind of how their minds work. So small things, I'm comfortable without saying the word rehab, but you know, within my scope, kind of working with that. But it kind of realizing that when you have an injury that's especially new, or actually even nagging injuries, just realize that to get there, something in your body has been pissed off long before you got to the pain part. So especially with tendon and ligament stuff, there's been some damage slowly accumulating over time before you start even feeling it. So kind of knowing that is like, okay, cool. So if that's now where I'm at, I'm feeling it now. It didn't happen over the short term, because you know when you get an acute injury, when it's a sprained ankle, you know, something pops, you're like, uh-oh. Like that's a whole nother boat. But for the nagging stuff, or the stuff that just like, okay, this is starting to show up a little bit, it's taken you a while to get there. So just realizing that, number one, it's going to take a while to probably get it to fully go away. But also, as you mentioned, you know, going a few weeks or a few days or doing nothing, that's just going to mask it. Because at that point, as they say, treating the symptoms, not the root cause. So I would encourage people to be active in their recovery, like go find a PT. Find somebody that has a background, or just, you know, be open to actually having to do a little bit of work to start rehabbing or prehabbing to get that feeling better. Because if you just do nothing, like, I just hope it goes away. Yeah, to your point, it's not going to. So I would say be active in starting to try to figure out what is happening and then go from there.
Yeah, there's one line I always use. I'm like, how do you repair your car when it breaks down? Do you just shove it in the garage, wait 2 weeks, and think mm-hmm. it'll get better?
Yeah, that's a good analogy. I like that one.
You actually, somebody's got to go in there and be a mechanic and figure out what's going on and then fix it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because like I said, it usually takes months, sometimes even years, for these things to show up. And at that point, you're not going to take 5 days off and then be like, ah, it's gone. It's cool. I don't feel anymore. But as soon as you go play again, it's going to be right back.
Yeah. So I'll say that people are worried, scared, expense in terms of getting a physical therapist. Do you have a cheat code for people to find a personal trainer or a trainer who has the knowledge, at least close to a physical therapist, so that they can work on it? Because I think you and I both know, I was CSCS, Certified Strength and Conditioning Specialist, mm-hmm. went to exercise science
sure.
for my undergrad. You come out of in my case, 5 years. You know, I didn't take four, but
yeah. No worries.
I enjoyed it. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But college is fun. You get out of there, and then you're like, wait a second, this 19-year-old has not the same certification that I do. They have one that trumps mine for gym managers because they took an online course for 6 weeks. And I've been studying this for the last 5 years. And yet somehow all these gyms are hiring them and saying that I need their little 6 week online certification.
Sure.
I was like, no, I earned this spot.
Mm-hmm.
But you and me are probably one in a million when it comes to trainers. So how does somebody hunt down the knowledgeable trainer that isn't going to wreck them and just throw them under 225 in a squat rack on day one?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the million-dollar question because it just, man, it's tough. Because, I mean, public gyms, like I said, I worked at one and I worked with some phenomenal other coaches. But when I would visit other gyms, obviously we would see some things and I'm just like, okay, well, knowledge base isn't quite there as well. But also here's the other thing. You could have somebody that has a multiple pieces of paper in regards to non-college-based accreditation, or people who have their master's or their bachelor's, whatever it may be, exercise science, kinesiology. But then they just either never soaked it in and or they're just absolutely terrible with people.
Yeah.
So they're not good coaches. So trying to navigate that can be a little bit tough. But I do tell people just to try to find somebody that listens to you. And then when they start speaking back, if they've kind of regurgitating some of the things you've mentioned, and realize, and you can kind of notice it at that point. Okay, cool. They're seeing what my priority is. They understand what it is. And now what's kind of their plan to kind of help me with my priority. That's a pretty good spot to be in. If they're just kind of like not necessarily taking what you told them and say, okay, we're going to do this. Then at that point, you know, if you don't feel listened to, then try somebody else. But at the same point, if you've been doing nothing, then starting small and trying something is a great place to start. I mean, the internet has, I mean, anytime I need extra ideas or I forget things, like it's my first resource. And then if I need specific stuff, then I can talk to people, text my resources. But I'm just like, oh yeah, what muscles attached to here? What's the insertion there? And then what are the exercises based around that? Okay, cool. I remember that. You know, like it's solid. So if you got knee stuff, if you can't do a single leg squat, half a foot down, cool. You should probably start with that. If your shoulders can't go past, you know, whatever the range may be, maybe we open that up. So just kind of start with the obvious things. If you can kind of figure out what that is and see what you're weak at. And that's a great place to start in regards to, yeah, just trying to do something to make yourself feel a little bit better.
Sure. You know, I'd say one of the things is if this trainer or this physical therapist, and there's, I don't know, 98% of them in my experience, if they don't ask you to move for them first,
mm-hmm.
no, without being underweight first, hey, can you walk? Okay. Can you run, side shuffle, like throw with me or spike a ball at me? Let me see how things are moving. Mm-hmm. And then putting you under lightweight and actually looking at you before assigning an exercise. It's so massively important, and it's almost disappointing and disgusting when a physical therapist who is, you're putting your health in their hands,
mm-hmm.
they don't even watch you move. They just lay you down on a table, feel around, and then, okay, this is what we're going to do. Like, I know that there's a numbers game into making that business work and insurance and everything, but they've got to at least watch you move before assigning any sort of long-term exercise prescription, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that, yeah. Once you kind of get past it, like, okay, this is cool, this person listens to me, then in that, exactly. They should be like, all right, well, let's test the areas. And then, as you say, let me watch you do your movement if it's still relatively safe, and see what that looks like. I 100% agree.
Now, I do want to kind of break some client privilege with you.
Maybe. No promises.
The freaks that you train, the AVP and FIVB players that you're training, is there any one attribute or quality physically that anybody has like shocked you with that you go, whoa, they're on another level compared to general population or even the rest of the volleyball population?
Oh, Yeah, totally. So I have access recently in the last, I guess, almost year now to Hawk and Dynamics force plates, which are no sponsorship, but I think they're the best as far as non-lab grade, which they actually are lab grade. But then what I've seen attributes from a beach volleyball standpoint versus others is, and that's one of the things I'm kind of actually chasing myself is data around these things. But the braking systems, essentially, because, you know, you have propulsion, different parts of the jump you can kind of break down, but the braking systems for beach athletes tends to be quite a bit higher than when I'm comparing to some of the NBA line stats that I have access to, some of the college basketball stats that I have access to. So they're not as quick. Maybe they don't jump quite as high, but man, when they're starting to put force into the plates in this case, or into the sand in the sport, it's strong most of the time.
Huh. What do you think that comes from? I mean, is it because we don't have the cardio running? Is it more of the power production? Because power production, either way, like the NBA guys are jumping higher, so they're producing more power there.
So are you would actually think so. So think about it this way. NBA players are very typically twitchy athletes, to say the least. But because of the sand, you don't get access to that twitch. That the ability to absorb and redirect ground forces is something that beach players just don't get access to. So it becomes very muscular dominant. So whatever your muscles can do, however fast they can relax and contract, however best they can organize, it's purely muscle based. So at that point, it makes sense that the muscles by themselves are able to generate the force to change the direction, like at the bottom of a jump. Versus twitchy athletes on hard surfaces where they can kind of lean more into their tendons and their ligaments a little bit and their nervous system. For us, it's purely muscle-based. So that's something that I work with our guys and girls on is how fast, if they're a little bit slow, my opinion, in their explosive movements, then it's starting to train and teach the muscles to relax faster. And then from there can activate faster. That's one of the big things we look at. But yeah. Generally speaking, it's muscle dominant. So that was something that was very interesting to me. And when you look at just a couple of studies, there's not much out there on sand-based research. It's the fact that the muscle force production is higher because there's less give. So muscles actually do more in the same countermember jumps. And they actually typically bend a little bit deeper into the knee and the hip and the ankle angles as well. Mm-hmm. So I found that like ankle mobility is much more important for beach players than basketball and tennis players. Like it's good. It's important for everybody, but for us, for staying upright torso, as like we're getting out of a jump, looking at the ball, we can't become a hip dominant, jumper. Like a lot of players can be successful in other sports. So we have to stay upright. So ankles become that much more important, but yeah. So deeper angles, more muscles, muscle action, force, and yeah. So it's cool stuff, but yeah, breaking is something that I've noticed that they have higher forces with.
Now, some people could take that and immediately interpret in their heads, and this is the two directions that mine went. Okay, so more muscular force generated from the sand. So one person says, that's why sand players jump higher when they go to indoor. But then my logical kind of research-based mind went, wait a second, because there's also the nervous system that we have to take into account, because mm-hmm. now this is a different type of jump that you can use from the indoor versus the beach.
Very different. Yeah, you're always going to jump higher indoor. But the thing is, if we took some of the crazier jumpers out of the beach and then put them on indoor for like 6 months and then train them with those type of plyometrics and whatnot, all hard surface trainings, it would get pretty crazy. But if you just take them straight out the sand on the cord court, yep, they'll jump higher. But if you let them adapt to that surface for even longer, they'll jump really high.
Hmm. So you think that, and are there any studies yet of combo sand training plus hard surface, or just hard surface, or just sand training?
Yeah, so maybe there's more out there. I mean, I haven't dug in the past few months. I'm hoping there's more, but basically, the conclusions were that you need access to more mobility, so deeper angles. But then if you don't play in sand that you should really probably stay away from it. If you're a baseball athlete, basketball, football, if you're coming back from a rehab standpoint, then sand can be amazing for any athlete. There's a lot of rehab purposes for getting into sand. But in regards to even just from a conditioning standpoint, it is great conditioning, especially if you're doing sand heels. But once again, you don't want to do too much of it because the adaptations that will take place will not be beneficial for your other surface.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Your main surface.
So the whole, you know, basically train like you play, mm-hmm. Should apply. If you're playing indoor and you want to jump higher indoor, train on indoor.
Mm-hmm.
If you're playing beach and you want to train and you want to jump higher in the beach, train on the beach.
Yeah. Yeah. That's like, we have sand legs right now. Like we were talking about playing tennis before we started, like my legs and joints, I go home once every few months to see my folks and my mom wants to go play pickleball. I'll go play with her for like an hour and a half. And then my knees just hurt the next day because I have not used that surface on my joints. But then I go on the sand 3 hours later, I'm like, all right, cool. Muscles are tired, but yeah, joints are fine. So it's, you want your body to adapt to what you want to be best at.
Okay. Good for everybody to know. And it's one of those, you know, the questions that you said where everybody's like, oh, well, you know, sand players, you jump so much higher when you come back to indoor. And it's like, no, you just feel like you do.
Yeah, and you got to be careful too.
Contact time is shorter.
Yeah, if you have not been on hard court for a few weeks or a few months, and you try to jump back into a high volume of load from a play standpoint, you're primed for something to go wrong. So you got to be careful. So
So yeah, you're saying to interpret that for listeners, if you're jumping on the sand consistently and you do that for 6 months and then you just decide to play the same amount of volleyball or the same hours, same number of jumps and sprints, but you just immediately transition to hard surface, it's not going to make you better.
You're going to have a bad time.
Like re-warm up. You need to jump less, play less on the indoor, and then build back mm-hmm. up to that high
yeah
rate.
Exactly. So you want to start with less. I mean, and that goes for almost anybody anytime. Like if you haven't been playing at all, I would not suggest going to play 4 days a week, 3 hours at a time. You know, you always want to ramp up, whether you come back from an off season, whether you just, you know, you're playing for fun and you've had a couple of vacations and it's been a few weeks, like take your time ramping back up. But if you're going from a soft surface to a hard court, you really want to start adapting. I would say before you even start playing again, like just start getting on a hard surface again, get some light, extensive plyos, just start feeling those ground forces again. But that was a couple of the things they talked about for the Super Bowl. Remember the guy that, if you watched or anybody watched, when he stepped off the sideline to run onto the field, ACL gone. Well, they were complaining earlier in the week that that surface was the hardest possible surface while still being NFL legal that you could have. So maybe it was that, maybe it wasn't, but either way, it was something that was different. They had not been practicing on a surface that hard. Yeah. So yeah, be careful, man.
Yeah. I get that. Like I get obsessed. We're talking about tennis. When I started playing tennis again, I got the taste for it. I had a little time.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I went from 0 to 2. And then the next week I went like 4 times for 2.5 hours each. And one of those was a private lesson where I told the coach, hey man, I'm an athlete. Absolutely bury me.
You know,
get me as many reps as you can in
for
these
sure.
75 minutes. Mm-hmm. And of course, then like the day, 2 days after that, I'm playing singles and my groin goes, boop, Mark, you know this.
But I mean, when you're having fun, I mean, I get it, man. Like when you're having fun, you're just like, you don't think about these things. So that's tough, especially when you're on the, you know, take it serious, but still the amateur side of things where you don't have coaches or staff or anybody kind of reminding you, hey, let's keep your workload here. I mean, it's a classic pitcher thing, but like, just keep the pitches limited until season, et cetera, and build up to it. But yeah, I mean, when you're having fun, like, I get it.
Tough to say no.
Mm-hmm, it is. But your body reminds you quickly and be like, ah, okay. So like anything else, like a lot of my guys, I'm like, hey guys, I mean, especially my tryhards, I'm like, I know you want to be on the sand 6 days a week. Cool. 5, 6. I get it. Let's incorporate some no jump days at the very least. You know, there's plenty of things you can work on without having to get out of the sand. And those are important because if you actually trying to make athletic gains at the same time that you're training this hard, then you need recovery. Like it's everything. That's where all the gains happen. So yeah, a couple no jump days. That could be one use of kind of limiting yourself a little bit.
Sure. Yeah, it's something that everybody, so in our programs, we got an online program where we take them through a 21-day mobility program, and then we take them through essentially a 10-week power and vertical program. But mm-hmm. we go through phases really quickly. Ideally, you know, if I had them for the full year, I would expand it. And I'm like, hey, are you in this for the long haul? Okay, we're going to expand each phase a few more weeks. And then we spend a tiny bit doing more high reps just to make sure that motor patterns are fixed and healthy sure. and balanced before we put them under a high load or heavy weight.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the question that we always get is, well, how many times can I play? How many times can I work out? And how do I push them together? How do I work out at the same time that I'm playing? If you had to answer that question for the
general population. Yeah, everybody's different. So it's once again depends on their background, their age, their seriousness, their ability to have time to recover. Like if you want to recover, like and make it optimal, which is another word for perfect, which nobody can do. But if you want to go that direction, it takes time and effort, and you know, depending on families, relationships, jobs, all that stuff, you may or may not have time. But it's going to be whatever you can recover from while still seeing progress. Is kind of how I see it. So if numbers are going up, if you're sleeping well, if your energy is still high, then we're probably in a good place. If we're seeing some things stay stagnant, if you get a little bit fatigued earlier in practice than you used to, you kind of have to pay attention to those type of things. But generally, as far as when you want to train around volley, I am different from what I've seen in that I have my guys and girls, if possible, anytime, if they're doing some lower body work, do it before sand. Because I keep my workouts relatively non-fatiguing since this is a muscle dominant sport. We do a lot of low rep stuff, high intent, and high effort, but you're not going to be knocking out sets of 10 or on any compound movement or anything like that. It's sets of 2 to 5, usually limited on the sets, so that when you do finish that, you're like, okay, cool. We saw the weights go up this week. We saw a speed increase if you're doing velocity tracking. Time to take off, go down if you're doing force plate stuff. All these numbers are showing us we're in the good place. It's better than the last couple of weeks. Cool. We're doing well. But yeah, you never want to do a workout lower body based if you're trying to get adaptations to increase athleticism, and do it before sand. Because even if you do a no jump session, 90% chance you're going to be fatigued, and you're not going to get that extra 5% that you would have had if you were fresh.
Okay. So if I'm unpacking that for weekend warrior who's got a little bit of gym experience, maybe mm-hmm. not.
Yeah.
If for your athletes, what you're doing is you're putting them into the gym with low repetitions, which means 2 to 5 repetitions in a set.
Mm-hmm.
Some of our weeks call for 1 repetition.
Yeah, totally.
And you're saying high intent and force production.
Mm-hmm.
Could you unpack that as if I'm in second grade?
Yeah, of course. So if somebody, say, has absolutely zero gym experience, you don't need anything fancy. Get, like you mentioned, get your movement patterns ingrained. Make sure your range of motion, you have access to it, all of it. Whether it's squatting, pressing, pull-upping, whatever. And then that should be kind of your focus. So a lot of the adolescent athletes, you just want to basics refine, then go play your sport. You don't need anything fancy. If you're a little bit more advanced in that, then high intent is going to be something where unless you find a strength deficit, like I'm extremely lucky to have the force plates, I can see people if they have access to a lot of strength, but when they jump, they only use 40% of it. Cool. We don't need to get stronger. We need to pull more of this strength into our athletic stuff. All right. Switch kind of the pull. If it's the opposite, strength phase, pretty simple. Just get stronger. But a lot of things people do is they tend to get a little grindy when they think high intent means, oh, it has to be really heavy. It has to go slow. No, I'd rather see moderate or lightweights move fast. If we're not trying to do maximal strength training, the loads need to move at a certain speed. And if they're not, then at that point, you're just training to be strong. And that's not something that's going to switch over to athleticism as easily. So that's kind of what I mean. So whether we're lifting heavier loads accordingly, medium or even light, like move the weight, like make it move. And even if it's a move that, okay, I can't really be explosive for this, like a classic hinging pattern, like an RDL or something, single leg RDL, but doesn't mean you have to be slow. Still come down with control, have a nice little pop on the way up. If it's too heavy and you lose your form or it's just too heavy that you can't have a pop, cool. Take it down a little bit, man. Ego doesn't matter.
Mm. So when you say that you want people to move weights quickly, and we're talking submaximal or you said moderate to light,
mm-hmm.
is there a percentage that you can give our audience? I usually tell people 30% of your one rep max. And guys, if you don't know what your one rep max is, it's the most amount of weight you could do once. And if you attempted it a second time, you would fail. So mm-hmm. let's say that it, like if your one rep max is 100 pounds in the squat, for some of my programs, we would have you 30% or below moving at maximum speed, so long as you've shown that you can actually do that with good technique. Mm-hmm. And then we would just say, yeah, if you've got a squat, like a bar on your back, or if you're carrying dumbbells, then you actually jump with that as high as you possibly can. Again, so long as you've proven that you can land well and you can take off well with good technique. But
yeah,
we're in the 30% or under for moderate to light. Is that what you mean, or do you have a specific number that you use?
So I used to use a percentage-based scale, but now that we can track bar velocity, whether it's in a barbell, trap bar, whatever it may be, I kind of use that. Because with percentages, what you'll notice, especially if you're a strength coach who deals with entire teams and you do that year-round for decades, what you'll notice is that somebody 60% 1RM on a squat, they can do 7 reps. Well, other guy over here, 60% his 1RM, he can do 10 reps. Hmm. So it's very individual as far as what people can do. So I use velocity tracking to be like, okay, this is the range I want to work in. When I'm working a strength phase between 0.5 and 0.8 meters per second, that's pretty slow, but it's not Olympic powerlifting slow. All right. So, and then if we're lifting, you know, a little bit faster for rate of force development and stuff, then a little faster. But yeah, it's such individual, and the percentage is not a bad place to start at all. I used to use it and it was a solid place, but as I've, you know, listened to other podcasts and other strength coaches, everybody's seen kind of their thing that went off in their head as a light bulb. And that was a big one for me. It was like, ah, it's true. Like I've seen different athletes, same 1RM percentages, and it's just a completely different set of reps. Mm. So if you were trying to push to failure, then the guy that could have done 10, he didn't quite get there. And the guy that was only get 7, well, he just got maxed out during a set, which we didn't want to do maybe, you know? So yeah, that's kind of where I stand on that. But it's pretty, if you know, nobody's have the fancy devices, I would say like, you can tell if you come up with speed and the bar flies off your shoulders, yo, that's fast. That is really fast. If it pops, but it doesn't come off, cool. That's fast, but not over speed. And then if you're, you know, if you're grinding on the other end of the spectrum, like, cool, man, that's probably a little bit heavier than what we want unless we're in a maximal strength phase. So yeah, I mean, people know when it pops and people know when it's slow. So living somewhere kind of in between there for whatever set of number of reps is a pretty good place to start.
Now, I know we're training for sport,
mm-hmm.
right? So you're not supposed to necessarily care too much about body shape, body composition, because if you can move fast and if you can produce the power, you can produce the power, you can move fast.
Yeah, right? It's all about how can you play your sport. That's mm-hmm. 100%.
And so the body adaptations that are going to come when I'm moving 2 to 5 reps pretty fast, is that something that I'm going to see in my body? Are you going to have muscle growth there? Is it going to be for people at home? If you want abs, that's going to happen in the kitchen.
Kitchen and in bed. Yeah. If you're not sleeping, your body fat's going to have a hard time coming off.
Mm, and sleep.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good point.
But
are they getting like the feeling of the burning when they're doing legs, or is it you're in? Okay. Now you're resting for a long time and you don't even feel like that typical kind of high school, like deep burn.
Yeah. So, I mean, it just depends on your goal. Like I competed as a natural bodybuilder for a few years. And so in that sport, you want to hit absolute failure, you know, one-ish set per week, you know, give or take, and just generally speaking here, but you want to take a set to just absolute destruction on occasion. That's not the case here. you want to stay super fresh so that each rep can be as fast as it can be, depending, or as strong as it can be. Like powerlifters, you know, they'll do one rep, maybe two, and then they'll go sit on their butt for 5 minutes. Well, there's a reason for that. It's because they want to have access to their nervous system recuperation and the muscle recuperation. So we're kind of living between, I do a lot of 2.5-3 minute rest stuff on the heavier compound stuff. But yeah, when you finish a set, if you've done grinding bodybuilder style workouts, you'll be like, I didn't even feel like I did anything. I'm like, yeah, but your nervous system adaptations that will come in a few weeks will say that you did. So that's kind of the cool thing. It's like, you don't need to kill yourself if the numbers are getting better. Just accept it and realize that hopefully the adaptations you're looking for and the interventions you're using for those are occurring.
So kind of moral of the story, stop measuring your workouts on how sore you are the next day.
Oh, sorry, I didn't touch on that. You should almost never be sore unless you do something brand new. Soreness is the worst indicator for athletes in my little small LA opinion over here. It's not something you should chase. Even professional bodybuilders, when I was doing that, if you were sore after every single workout, you're clearly under recovering.
Mm. Right. Yeah. It doesn't make sense to do it. And you get soreness because your body is not used to a movement,
mm-hmm.
or you've pushed it so far beyond its limits that it takes 2, 3, sometimes 4 days to recover.
Yes.
Now the next 2, 3, 4 days, instead of adapting, you're just recovering. And yes, there's a mix when we say that, mm-hmm. but you're just barely recovering. In the meantime, you got to get back to work.
Yeah.
And you're still under recovered. So like when you're playing now, you're playing as if, you know, somebody has basically slashed your muscles and now you have to play and compete with literally torn muscles.
Yeah. Yeah. I constantly check in with my athletes as far as general fatigue. I was like, hey, we had a 2-a-day this day, whether it's 2 sand sessions or a strength and a sand session, how are we feeling? And then how do we feel the next day? I'm constantly checking in as far as that, because at the end of the day, our job is to make them better at their sport. That's mm-hmm. what they're here for. That's what they pay you for. That's the reason. So cool. Chasing numbers in the gym is also a great thing. That's a great indicator of progress. But once again, if my guy or girl is not feeling faster or more explosive or more fatigue resistant when they're playing, then cool, we need to try something else.
I had a girlfriend. She was the Norwegian national team, and she went to France to play. She was a setter and she was fast and she could put size on, she could put muscle on, and she was a mm-hmm. great lifter. Her coach in France kept saying, you can do more, you can do more, you can do more. Why are you holding back? And she was just like, I can easily put muscle on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just getting bigger. I'm just getting slower. Why do you need me to get stronger in the weight room when I'm a setter?
Yeah.
I just need to be fast and light and use my hands. And she really butt heads with that coach. She's like, I know I can do more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is not going to give me any advantage when I'm a setter who's like, okay, now I'm bulking up and I'm becoming a worse actual setter. Do you want me to be mm-hmm. a power lifter or do you want me to be a volleyball player?
Yeah, 100%. Want to stay in the body size and shape that you perform your best at. Some people perform best from an endurance standpoint when they're a little bit heavier. Just because their body really hates being lean. And then like your girlfriend who has genetics I wish I had like 10 years ago when I was bodybuilding, they just gain muscle without even thinking about it, which can be an issue in this sport when we're trying to jump out of sand or in that case, trying to be fast and light on an indoor setting. Yeah, you don't want to have excess body weight, muscle or fat. So yeah, if you play long enough, you'll kind of, one of the questions I ask is like, okay, when did you feel your most athletic at what size? What weights, and then, or how close to that are we right now and how we feel comparatively?
Yeah, I think when I was a bit bigger, and I'm not skinny, but when I was a bit bigger, I felt jumpier, faster, more explosive on the court.
Mm-hmm.
And that was through some consistent lifting in that way. So I
some people need to hypertrophy a little bit. I would agree. I've seen some players out there, there's like skin and bones, and I'm like, all right, they need just maybe a little bit extra, because oftentimes you'll find that those are the players that fatigue pretty fast sometimes. Not always, but it's something to look out for. And in the other people, it's just like, hey man, if you're going to last a 9-month season, you're going to need a little bit more mass on you. same thing with football players. If they're going to absorb all those collisions, when they have more muscle and fat, they usually come out a little bit healthier.
Yeah. Hmm. I like those. I'm really interested in those force plates. Have you ever used the, I forget the GymAware? It's like an attachment to the barbell, and it's got
That's a velocity based tracker. Yes, I have the laser based GymAware one myself. Yep.
Was that similar? You just found that the new force plates that you're using, those just gave you overall better, more accurate information.
There are two different products. One just measures speed of the bar,
okay,
which is very, very useful. Plus, it's great because that's a huge – they actually did some good research on when players or athletes have access to the bar speeds in real time right in front of them. They'd be like, hey, here's your goal. Cool, you just hit a 0.56. All right, man, this next rep, you got to beat that. And so they become – the competitive nature comes out. And then what they notice is there after a long – I forget how long the study was, but they roughly came up that – somebody who has access to velocity trackers in real time, it was an 8% difference in gains, if you want to call it that.
Whoa.
Which is huge. If you're in the professional world, like monster. If you get 3% better or anything, that's big. 8% is a massive difference. And these were, I think, professional rugby players. So fast, explosive athletes. And that was the difference. So that's big time. So they're seeing them in a lot more strength and conditioning gyms. They've been around for a long time in the high-end places, but you're starting to see them in more garages like mine because it makes a huge difference.
That's monster.
8%. Yeah, it's big time. That was I loved hearing that. I'm just like, but it's because it's true. Like, I've been using it longer than my athletes, and I get really angry if I don't hit the number I want to hit. So that effort comes out real quick.
And I love it, like, because it's almost gamified when you've got it on the iPad there,
mm-hmm.
and you see just like the little circle meter go up.
Yep.
You didn't quite hit it, and you're like, God damn.
Yeah, yeah, mine, and yeah, you can have sound effects too. So when if you hit the number, because you can set a goal too, like I want to be every rep to be over 0.65, whatever, and it'll ding and be turned green if you hit it. And then it'll do a thud sound and turn yellow if you don't. And my guys and girls hate that thud sound. They hate that sound because it's a negative sound, man. It makes you think like straight negativity. If there was a tone that said, I hate this, that's the sound you hear. So we want the dings, man. We want all the dings.
What are you doing for there? So in general, it sounds like you're doing hex bar deadlifts and almost jumps. Squats. What are your general lower body exercises that are pretty typical for everyone for volleyball players? Mm. And then what are your upper bodies that you don't do and upper bodies that you do?
Let's see. Everybody's different. Some people absolutely love having a bar on their back. Mm. So I try to work within people's interest as well. It helps bring more intent. There's that word again. Some people have pain in their shoulders or neck or whatever. Maybe I want to squat. Okay, cool. No worries. So trap bar, barbell, safety bar are the three main things I use for my bilateral compound lifts. The safety bar is a good in between.
When you say bilateral, that's two legs going.
2 feet on the ground. Yeah. Producing force. So your typical back squat, deadlift, all those things. But yeah, so the squatting pattern is going to be, because our entire sport of volleyball is based on basically what your quads can do. So that's the pattern that we work the most is a squat pattern, which is knee dominant, which is your lunges, your back squats, your upright deadlifts, if you're using a trap bar. Mm. So those are kind of the three main drivers I use. And then, or three main.
What's the difference between an upright deadlift and a normal deadlift?
So you can think about it as we say the words hingy and squatty. Yep. So squatty means you're just a little bit more upright. Hingy is the more classic deadlift. Your hips are shot further back and your chest and chin are down. So at that point, you recruit a lot more from your glutes and your hams. And then the upright is just your I love trap bar for that because you get into just your strongest power or jump stance with that sucker pretty naturally. And it's good form out of the box typically. So I'm a big fan of that. But yeah, you're just a little bit more upright. So that way the quads and then the hams or glutes and can all kind of work together as a team.
I'd say if you sit in there with that chest and you're just holding... we had to correct one of our guys, our online members, and he kind of like bent down. The first move that he did was he dropped his chest to go down for mm-hmm. a hex bar. And I was mm-hmm. like, okay, look 1,000 yards into the distance, like use the
yep.
horizon stare mm-hmm. and then just slide your hands straight down while keeping as high as you can. And
yeah.
it was going to be obvious that he wasn't going to be able to lift as much from that position. But number one.
Yeah. I mean, your glutes and hams are typically stronger than your quads, usually for the average person. I mean, the glutes, big ass muscle. Ha. But
and it puts you, that's like the, such the natural block position. If you just go into an upright hex bar squat, or hex bar deadlift, that is the position that you're blocking from if you're a blocker. You know, that's very typical. There's a little bit more hinge that you might have with a takeoff from an approach. But I think for the perfect blocker exercise, that straight upright hex bar deadlift is perfect so long as you don't lean over.
Yeah. I completely agree. And like I said, it's just easy to hold that bar and get into your more knee dominant position, and which is what you want to do. If you block with your hips, shoot the butt back, then you're going to be slower than somebody who just bends the knees and goes. Now, that being said, if you're a taller athlete, getting deep is maybe something that's not comfortable for you, or you're just slow. I've seen a lot of the taller.
Because of height. I always have this argument / discussion. That like taller people have trouble being mobile, or that they have, you know, trouble being fast or athletic. And I just think it's a percentage thing where it's like, okay, there's, you know, point of 6'3" people on earth are super athletic, but there's so many 6'3" people that we just see a lot more of them. And if you talk about 6'7", 6'8", 6'9", there's a smaller number of people of them. So the most of the 6'9" people you see are probably less athletic, but actually most of the 6'9" people you see are probably the athletes because they're on TV.
Yeah, 100%. But even then, like body types, like, you know, Anders Moll is somebody who's what, 6'8", 6'9". But if you just see him on TV, he's got the proportions of a normal size human. So you're like, oh yeah, he's like 6'2", 6'3", he's tall, right? You stand next to him, you're like, wow. Whereas somebody, some people in the NBA, you know, have really long legs and really short torsos. You're like, oh, that person's definitely like above average for their sport. So it depends on your body dimensions as well. And then also your body type, obviously a mole versus say a Alisson, they're going to move different. They're very different body types, play the same position. But so what I do is, you know, so like I kind of look at somebody's blocking technique if they're a blocker and just see where they're comfortable, where their bending is. Maybe we can try to increase the range a little bit, but for the most part, if they block with a quarter squat, which a lot of the, female athletes do, cool. Let's work within that. Let's see how fast and powerful and quick we can get them in and out of that block and see if we can add some explosiveness using those angles that they're already comfortable with and have a million reps behind. But also if you like, if your ankles suck though, maybe we open you up and all of a sudden you can get deeper naturally with when the ankles open up, and then you can get more height or jump out of that. But yeah, a lot of people
questions where we're always looking at blockers, and everything that we get asked is how deep should I go. And my answer is always, when's the last time you tested?
Yeah. And then just see what angle you feel the fastest at that moment. Because, yeah, maybe there's a strength deficit. Maybe there's a mobility deficit. But at that moment, like, what feels most explosive, that should be where you go for it. Then if we see as a coach, those hips are really shooting back. All right, cool. We got a hinge jumper, and that's going to be always a little slower versus knee in this sport. So that's something you can work on. But yeah, it's what you feel fastest with. Check out those angles. And if there's no restrictions, then let's make you more explosive in those angles.
And it is interesting that you said, well, you've already had a million reps at this depth. So
if you're a high level player,
efficient at that depth, right?
Yeah. Just to give you an example from me, I have my own coach as well, performance coach. And with all my years of basketball, I just can't bend my knees extra in sand. I jump with the exact same angles, knee angles, as I did on the court, which is more shallow. When I watch all of the more explosive athletes jump in sand, like we said, they're deep. Their hips and their knees are cranked if they're not having any mobility issues. And so I was like, okay, cool. Let me just get more mobile, more flexible in my ankles and my hips and my knees. And I did that. Nothing changed. And she thinks it's because I have millions of jumps like this. That's what my body wants to do. So I'm like, all right, cool. At this point, I'm almost 40. That's not going to change. So let's work within this and then go from there.
It's always tough for people to get word on or try to get information on. So I had a chiro in, I guess, my last year playing college. And he talked about that I had Cross syndrome in my low back, and like we could override it. And I was like, well, let's fix it. He goes, hang on. if you try a new motor pattern right now, he goes, it might make an inch of difference. Mm-hmm. It might make none. Yeah. You don't know because you've never gone to that side. He goes, but how much training time are you going to give up in order to get that answer of maybe it's more efficient? Mm-hmm. He goes, you might just stick with it. This is your senior year. You've got playoffs coming. He goes, don't waste your time changing everything right now. He goes, if you want to spend a really long off season doing it, okay, change it then. But it's time for playoffs. So whatever you got, ride with it.
Yeah. I have a good example for that. The example I always use with people is if you ever watch Kobe Bryant walk, he had some pretty mad internal rotation on his knees. And that's how he walked. So are you going to be the PT or the coach or the trainer that says, hey, Kobe, let's not play like that. Let's not walk like this anymore or move like this because you're terrible at your sport. Nah, man, you can let him have that. And you're just going to be like, all right, let's not get hurt. And I'm not going to change anything because he's obviously a top three player of all time. Let's not mess with that at all. So, yeah, you want to keep people safe. But at a point, if they perform at a high level, your goal is to not rock the boat and just kind of help them be a little more resilient.
Cool.
Oh, and to go back to your question. So, on the exercises, trap bar squats and deadlifts, back squats, of course, and barbell, safety bar squats. And then I love safety bar reverse lunges, bringing the foot back forward after you finish each one. I'm a big guy on that, especially having the hands on the rack. It creates a little stability, and then you can really get some high force output because you always have some kind of single leg exercise. And then from there, as far as upper body stuff, I'm a big fan of have your basic patterns, you know, two or three sets a week of a horizontal press, bench press, some kind, not a barbell.
Two or three sets a week.
Yeah. So shoulder press and a horizontal press. I typically go more inclined because of the more anterior delt, which if you're a non-rotational hitter, like you swing a lot from your arm, which is bad in itself. But if you are, you can make that one muscle a little bit stronger and then pray. But then anytime I can get some overhead scapula rotational work in, you're pulling your pushes and, whether it's through cables or a free weight, I'm a big fan of that. So I do a lot of kettlebell stuff where we can get rotation and fully extended stuff, working all in one. If you can check a lot of boxes with one exercise, then I'm a big believer in those.
Interesting. So would you spread the two or three sets? Are these the same? Are you doing the same number of reps? Or are you doing a little bit higher and lighter reps?
When I start with people, I typically start a little bit lighter and then just kind of build into the strength. And then we just kind of maintain. I mean, it always depends, as I'll keep saying, where their foundation is at. Like you said, when I bring somebody in, I see how they move. I see what injuries they've had in the past. I see the things that they want to improve on and their training history. And then from there, we build kind of the pieces from there. And then I just, even if they're like the best ever, there's still certain things that be like, all right, I still want to start you here. I want to see this. And then we can go from there.
And the idea of what's the point with upper body? Like if you've got healthy, mobile shoulders and you're protecting them and you've got base strength, mm-hmm. do you need to or want to get stronger? And in doing so, dedicate the energy loss.
Yeah. And half the time when people, exactly. Yeah. You don't need much. You want to put a lot of drops of the bucket into rotation. Cause that's how we generate power because we're the one sport that needs rotational power where our feet are off the ground. Right. Mm-hmm. So doing a lot of like med ball throws at baseball players is not bad. It's good, but baseball players are also using their hips to drain a lot of that force. So I get, little creative in some of the things I do, but yeah, just rotation in general. Like if your spine doesn't want to go left or right, up or down, that's something that you're going to want to open up for another reason than more power when you hit, if you can access that. So rotation is something that I bring in a lot in, but yeah, as far as just getting where you compress 100-pound dumbbells over your head. Yeah, man, we don't need that. It's not going to make you hit harder. No, if anything, it's gonna make you slower.
Right. Okay. So then if we're talking about a row, we're probably rowing back, but then adding like a little twist.
You can do rotation and anti-rotation, but for most people, I typically like to start lubricating their spine a little bit. So yeah, anytime where you're pulling and rotating at the same time, both directions is going to be good. And it usually like feels really nice on people's spine. They're like, oh, that's nice.
Do you prioritize back over front? So as opposed to push and press, do you do more sets for, let's say, pull-ups and rows? Or
not necessarily, unless I feel like there's a big deficit. Like, I've seen people that have like a huge pulling deficit versus their pressing abilities and vice versa. So then at that point, yeah, we'll throw in a couple of extra sets to try to bring up the weaker pattern, because we don't want to have – everybody's going to have an imbalance. People are afraid of that word. But unless I'm seeing something that's 10, 20% of a greater differential, then at that point I'm not too worried. But if it's something that I'm like, oh, that's a pretty big difference, let's bring that up, then yeah, we'll introduce either more sets or more volume in general.
Right. Nice. Well, Nathan, we're going to start wrapping this up. I just want to make a quick announcement to anybody who's listening. If you do want to try out our mobility program or our 60-day max vertical program, we have that for you in the Complete Player program. The links are around here. You get a free drill book with it. Just click on the link in the description. But if you want to work with Nathan, he's going to tell you all about his programs, where you can find him, and how you can sign up for him if he's got any more room on his client list, because I know you're hogging basically all the AVP now.
This is not true. You're too kind, sir. But yeah, we've got a few players that are looking to do big things this next year. Yeah, I'm not great with social media. I barely have an Instagram, but it's devour_fitness_LA on Instagram. So you can shoot me a message there, or just devourfitnessla@gmail.com. You can send me an email there as well. So yeah, I stay decently busy, but I'm always open to have a chat. Like, I'm just happy to grow the sport any way that I can help. Because yeah, I'm just science-based musclehead that fell in love with beach volleyball again. So I'm just trying to help, man.
What town are you operating out of? So
I am, if you're in the LA area, I'm kind of between Marina Del Rey and Culver City. And then, of course, I do a little bit of some online programming for folks as well. I'm pretty full there, but you can always shoot me a message. People come in and out on that degree. But it's something that I've actually really enjoyed, is working with people from across the country at all levels. So awesome. That's cool. Yeah, because I'm just people like, I got a guy in Milan in Pittsburgh. I'm like, people play volleyball in Pittsburgh? I was like, really?
Grass.
That's awesome. It's, yeah, so I'm just like, it's cool. It's cool to see, yeah, all the scenes that are around the U.S. It seems to be growing. So that's what we all want.
Cool, awesome. Well, guys, if you want to work with Nathan, Devour Fitness, you can find him in L.A. You can find his online programs. Hit him up. We will make sure that we include all of his handles on the description and in the captions below. If you like this episode, give it a thumbs up, give it a like, subscribe, and send it to somebody who needs it or wants it. Really appreciate you listening, and hopefully we can see you at an event coming up soon. Remember to check out betterbeach.com/events to see all of our upcoming camps and clinics. And from me and Nathan, that's all. We'll see you on the sand. Now, Nathan.